Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
How lovely are the people listening to this podcast?
Dude, the response to last week's Game and Habits podcast, which I really loved recording with you, by the
way. Same,
thank you.
Such
a laugh doing that. It was great. Like, I loved everyone. Like, a bunch of people got in touch on Twitter, and I was laughing at all the responses. And
it carried over as well into the Entitled Banter podcast, where we talked about just what constitutes a meal. I had a KFC for an evening, quote-unquote, meal last night. It was not fully satisfying.
No!
It was not an evening meal. I tried to go against the grain. It was a bad grain.
Man, I immediately, after that podcast, I didn't plan on this, but I went home and ordered a double
succulent Chinese
Big Mac,
meal.
A succulent Chinese meal, a double Big Mac, and some chips and some nuggets, and that was like the best meal I had all week. It was absolutely gorgeous, it was, but yeah, just ultimately, I kind of wanted to shout everyone out, because it was lush that everyone got in touch, and I really appreciated all the response, especially the ones that said, Josh, you're right, you are right, actually, I am a lot like you, so I liked that.
I know, I don't know the specific person's name, because thankfully we did get a lot of responses, and genuinely, a massive thank you to everybody who listened. It's an honor to be heard by everybody, it's genuinely awesome. But a couple of people just saying, like, they resonate so much with the stuff you were saying about, like, staying away from gaming marketing, making sure that they're picking and choosing what they're playing, and not letting the industry dominate the stuff that they play, and that they felt very seen. And it's like, there's an emerging contingent of people who push against just how regimented the gaming industry is, and there's a lot of benefits to living that way.
There is, I think, you know, not to reiterate everything we mentioned last week, but it's a nice thing to give yourself. It's a nice treat to give yourself, I always find. And I did it this week with a bunch of other games, Scott Tilford.
You did, which is a perfect segue into... We're going to talk about Final Fantasy 16, but we want to cover a couple of little horrors that deserve the spotlight, because obviously right now, in amongst Diablo 4, Street Fighter 6, Final Fantasy 16, the AEW game's out in 3 days. That's not on the same tier whatsoever, but it will be for me. It's very hard for smaller games to stick out. And two games, one specifically Amnesia the Bunker and also Stay Out of the House, are both kind of doing the rounds. I feel like Amnesia's doing even more of the rounds than Stay Out of the House, but they're both worth talking about.
They are, man. They're both great games. For me, Stay Out of the House, I mentioned this in the UBP, is better than Amnesia the Bunker. It's a Game of the Year contender for me. I finally finished it and I absolutely loved it. By the way, this is hilarious because I've played through both of these games to completion literally days after we last recorded the last wind-up, where I said, Scott, I'm having a break from games now that I've finished Zelda. I'm going to wait until Final Fantasy. These two just popped up and I couldn't resist. I'm going to describe them both because, funnily enough, they share like loads of similarities. So Amnesia the Bunker and Stay Out of the House are both first-person horror games about trying to escape a location. In Amnesia the Bunker, that is a World War One bunker that has been torn apart by a mysterious monster that is scuttling in the walls.
Okay.
In Stay Out of the House, you are trapped in the house of a serial killer called the Butcher. You get taken, you get locked into a cage, and he's kind of set the house up with a bunch of traps because he's trying to scare you
for
3 days before he kills you. So you have 3 days to escape. And in both games, the kind of puzzle heavy. You have to explore the areas to unlock new wings of a location with very specific items to, you know, get around a grate that you need a wrench to, you know, remove or something like that. And both games have a persistent monster that you can't kill, but will chase you around the entire location. Mm. But fortunately, it's not a run and hide game necessarily, because you do have tools at your disposal. In both games, you have a revolver. And this kind of sums up the survival horror approach of both, I think. In both games, you have a revolver that you don't know the ammo count of, you have barely any ammo for, and to check the ammo count, you have to pull the cylinder out in a very slow animation, look at how many bullets are in that cylinder, reload manually one by one taking the shells out, and then flick the cylinder back in, and you have barely no ammo. The cool thing about Amnesia the Bunker is that every time you shoot the monster, it comes back tougher. Okay. So the first time it might pop out, you might use a bullet to send it packing. But the next time it arrives, it'll take two bullets. The time after that, it'll take three bullets, bullets. And because bullets are so scarce, you know, it's it becomes more of a risk-reward thing.
But I think Resi should have had that.
It should, man. Yeah. You do get other items in the bunker, like grenades, and you eventually get a shotgun that help you as well. The bunker is more of an immersive sim kind of style thing. It says right at the beginning that there are a bunch of ways to get through the levels, and you're encouraged to experiment. Like, every obstacle will have a kind of slightly different way around it, depending on how you combine the items at your disposal and what you have on your inventory. Mm-hmm. And the bunker, kind of like a great horror game that I played a few years ago called Deadwood, is slightly procedurally generated. Right. So every playthrough, items spawn in different areas, so you can't like rely on guides as you would, because like the codes for lockers or certain areas are always different each playthrough, which is really scary.
Yeah.
And the location of the monster is always different and stuff like that. Amnesia the Bunker is kind of like a great cross between that Deadwood game and Alien Isolation, whereas Stay Out of the House, which I loved a little bit more, is kind of more atmospheric. It's lower budget, but it's purposefully evoking a PS1 art style. So you've got that kind of those low polygons, the kind of weird shapes of, you're not sure what is like further on down the hallway, because you literally can't make it out, because it's like, is that a humanoid shape? Is it a lamp? Is it a door? Okay. You don't know. And it also throws over the top, and you can disable this, but a VHS filter and a CRT monitor filter, which
I'll turn all that off,
is trying to take you back to 1995. And I loved both games, but that one in particular, just, you know when a game is just for you? This was absolutely that. Like, I didn't even, it wasn't on my radar at all, and I was just doing a thing where I was looking through the recently added games to the PlayStation Store, and I mentioned this in the UBP, but my girlfriend kind of pointed at it as a joke, because the main cover of it is intentionally B-movie infused.
Yeah, like, it looks
weird. It looks old, it looks dated, it looks kind of silly, but intentionally so, but you wouldn't know that if you were just flicking through it. And I clicked on it, saw this lush art style, jumped in. Absolutely terrifying, great games. Loved them, man. Really loved
them. I am curious for Amnesia, because I played a tiny bit of Dark Descent. I finished Machine for Pigs, and then now it's like The Bunker. I feel like Amnesia as an IP is like something that a lot of people bounced off on Dark Descent. Like, a lot of people played it, but it kind of got wrapped up in things like Dear Esther and Gone Home in those early 2010s games, where it was like, they're walking sims. Not much happens. It's a lot of what's in the shadow. You never actually see any creatures or whatever. Do you think that The Bunker is the most like, not necessarily accessible, but the most like, you can just give this to someone and they'll have a good time. There's way less caveats with it, or is it still kind of similar to the originals?
Funnily enough, I think there's more caveats than the originals, because the originals, and I need to stress, by the way, like, I'm not even an Amnesia fan. Like, love the
Me
stuff.
Neither, really.
I love some of the stuff that studio's done. Soma is one of my favorite games ever, but the Amnesia series, for whatever reason, maybe it was the settings, maybe it was the characters, maybe it was the tone, I always kind of bounced off it. But I would say they were kind of at least accessible, because they didn't have much to them from a gameplay point of view, I don't think. You were doing a lot of hiding, a lot of running.
So like, they were called walking sims.
Like you said, you know, they're kind of walking sim inspired, where you're going to get the story and kind of anyone can play it. Amnesia the Bunker has way more gameplay elements, but they're way more hardcore. Right. Like, it's a survival game through and through. You're expected to fail through trial and error. There's only really one save point in the game, like a centralized area in the bunker. In every run to try and complete one of the wings is kind of like, it's almost, it's not roguelike in nature, because it doesn't change in death, but you're kind of expected to die along the way. You're expected to be knocked back to that save point to execute another plan or a variation of that plan. And in that sense, I think it's actually maybe more restrictive than the other amnesias,
right,
because
okay.
you're going to lose progress. You need to juggle your inventory, which is incredibly limited. Like I said, you only have a few bullets for offense. You might get lost. You might not know where to go. It's kind of open-ended. Yeah,
because I'll get lost.
The whole bunker is like, you don't have many directives. You need to read the notes scattered around the bunker to know where to go next. It's
whilst
like
Whilst being hunted.
Yep, and there's that persistent enemy at you all the time. And even worse, Scott Tailford, or even better, depending on how much you love this, I have an anxiety condition, so I hate this, right? Not only is this persistent enemy after you, not only do you have a limited inventory, but you also have a generator that needs to be topped up with gas. Oh, otherwise, the whole bunker plunges into darkness, and then you can't see where you're going. And if you make noise, then the beast will come for you. So you're, every time you go out on a quote-unquote run, you're always aware of how much time does the generator have? How much gas is in there? Do I need to go back with the gas that I found to top it up before to bank my progress or what? So there, there's so many stresses on you in that game.
That's a pretty cool, cool structure though that gets around the sort of the thing that I hate about dark levels that I literally just can't see where I'm going, but I'm stuck in them, like in the depths where I'm just like, there's the thing I need is somewhere in here, and I can't do it. At least you're sort of aware of when it's going to go pitch black and you can sort of mitigate it.
That is true. And don't get me wrong, there are still some pitch black areas even if you put the generator on, but it's cool the way that it makes everything into like a strenuous mechanic. Like you do have a flashlight, but it almost works kind of like a chainsaw that you rev. You have to kind of pull a cord.
That's cool.
But every time you pull the cord, it makes a lot of noise. It's revving up. So if you're in that dark area, you do have this thing to rely on, but you might make loads of noise revving it up, and then the monster might kind of realize you're there, and then it'll pounce on you, you know?
The thing with Amnesia Games, because I reviewed A Machine for Pigs, it was one of the first games I ever had access to early. Shout out to newgamernation.com. I don't know if they're still alive anymore, but I used to work for them. And so I got access to Machine for Pigs. Now, I thought that game was extremely atmospheric and super effective and brilliant. The idea of just this like pig sounding humanoid thing that was following you through like Victorian England, or it looked like Victorian England, and you could hear it, and you could like, you just went into a room and then the door would lock behind you and it was right there, but you couldn't see it. At some point, I was too curious and I was like, I'm going to wait and let it catch me because I want to know what this thing looks like. And there was one bit where you're in like a darkened room and it's like a big sort of platform, underground, I think you are. And I just kind of waited. I knew that you could hear it. It was right there in terms of the audio design. So I just let it catch up with me. And it looked terrible. It was like, it would look like a weird PS1 model in amongst everything else. And I love PS1 models, but it just looked terrible. That whole game just sort of fell apart at that point.
Right.
Have you let the bunker creature find you? And does it look good? Without necessarily spoiling it, but is that effective?
I think it looks good. I do think it's effective. Like when this, when the creature comes out of the walls and starts hunting you, like
I love a creature in the walls.
Man.
Alien like, Isolation.
Oh, man. When you walk, cause like there's like sort of like these Tom and Jerry style like openings in the wall at the bottom. And sometimes you don't know where the creature is. You can just hear it scurrying.
But I just imagine you doing the Tom scream for a second.
Yeah, like, I was. But sometimes you can see it's like claw, like sort of protruding from one of these holes. And
that
if you walk past it, it's going to jump out on you.
Right, okay.
Like the design, like, yeah, if you keep getting killed by it, it will probably stop being scary. Mm. But I think the design itself is really cool.
Okay.
And the tension, like you said there, and sort of the sound design is incredible because not only can you hear it, you know, rummaging around, but you're in a World War One bunker. There is a war going on above you. So sometimes you'll be walking through and the entire bunker will shake because you'll hear an explosion on the top because someone's mortaring the position or something. So it's like you can never really tell if what you're hearing is the bunker itself, if it's the war going on above, or if it's the monster behind you, which is really neat. But speaking of great sound design,
yes,
I think Stay Out of the House might even have better sound design. That was one, right? Like you mentioned there, when sometimes in these horror games, when you see the creature chasing you, and once it grabs you a certain amount of times, you just kind of get frustrated because you're like, oh, that's just progress lost. You're not scary anymore.
That was
you're
it
just
in an obstacle. Alien, yeah.
Every single time I alerted the killer in Stay Out of the House to my presence, it hits you with this soul-piercing shriek that is so scary. Like every time it was effective, and I got caught a lot.
Right, okay.
It would just maintain that sense of dread all the way through. I was so scared every single time he was around, even more so than the bunker. Out of the two, Stay Out of the House is better for me, but that's maybe the harder sell because it is this kind of PS1 style throwback. It is more obtuse because it's also taken, you know, inspiration from 1990s survival horror games where you can just get kind of lost and you might not even know what to do. I got stuck in the opening section for ages before I got my bearings. Mm. But if it does click with you, terrifying, so good, and just, oh man, so unique.
I am loving the return of PS1 aesthetics. I feel like they're very few and far between. Even something like Signalis was such a callback to like Resident Evil 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And 3 as well. And then Devil Daggers is like an old school kind of Doom looking thing. You've got this, which is like lots of polygonal horror. And I feel like we talk about polygonal horror quite a lot.
Yeah.
Because there were so many like weird looking creatures in a lot of those old games, like in Tomb Raider, the Atlanteans, I think they were called in Tomb Raider 1. And there's things with the big fangs and everything. There's like, there's something about the lack of detail that makes your mind fill it in and fill the gaps in, and you subconsciously render it out yourself, and that can be really effective.
Dude, that is absolutely it with Stay Out of the House in particular, especially because the, you know, like the environment that you're in does have a lot of detail. There's a lot of spooky stuff you can find in the house. But to me, its biggest strength is that it leaves you for long periods of time without a scare and without much like music. Like there's so many moments in that game where you're just kind of walking around the corridors and it's eerily quiet and you can hear every kind of creak, and the game is patient with its scares, and I love that so much. It has a prologue called Night Shift, which is not set in the house. It's the prequel to how one of the butcher's victims was taken, and
that's
you play
cool.
this character going to the night shift, going for their night shift at a kind of a store in the middle of nowhere, like a gas station. And you play out that entire shift. And for the bulk of it, nothing happens, right? You're just there sweeping up. You're there moving around the items, like, you know, packets of crisps and beer that needs to be
put on
the
shelves.
It's
going to remind me of working retailers.
But without spoiling too much, like, the way that thing builds, because, you know, it really captures the idea of being alone and kind of everyone who comes in is like a suspect, but you don't know what their intentions are. You see this van driving around and it doesn't stop, and you think, were they scoping me out? Were they just kind of pulling in for some other reason? And the way it builds on your imagination, exactly like you said then, it builds that dread to the eventual payoff, which is great. I just think it's magnificently done, and I wasn't expecting it.
But that's the thing. Both these games sound awesome. I want to play both of these things. There is no time on this earth right now. Like, I've done enough of Diablo 4 where I'm like satisfied with it, where I'm very aware of the loops that make up that game. And so, like, I did that across the last sort of couple of weeks where I was like, cool, I get what this is. I'm, like, level 30 rogue or whatever. I've done enough. I've started, like, 5 saves. I've done a little bit in each class.
Yeah.
But my point is that there are so many games right now that I'm trying to get to a point with, I'm either trying to finish them or I'm trying to get to a point with them where I identify the gameplay loops and I'm like confident enough of having a conversation on it. Diablo is never really designed to be finished. There is a main story. But it's one of those things where, like, I would love to play both of these games, but I'm also like neck deep in Final Fantasy 16.
I get it, man. Like, I came away from both of these games, and like I said, Stay Out of the House was a huge surprise, and it's published by a company called Puppet Combo.
Yes.
We have a bunch of other games as well on console, which is great for me. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of want to put Final Fantasy down in play those. But before we move on to Final Fantasy, I want to ask you a question, because
yes.
we started talking about this before we started recording, and I mentioned there that Stay Out of the House has this art style that is evocative of VHS grindhouse movies, and you combine that with a PlayStation 1, you know, art style, and you might have something that is unappealing to look at because it is grainy.
Or fuzzy.
It's fuzzy. It's all got this gray sheen on it because it's like a VHS, which didn't have, you know, great contrast or black levels or whatever.
Yeah.
And you can turn that stuff off, but I worry, and I totally get why, that it might be off-putting to people experiencing what I think is a great horror game.
My thing is always going to be, because I just want my, like, I'm 34.
Yes.
I grew up through a lot of fuzzy-ass TV time, and as things got clearer, HD came in, 4K came in. Clarity is good. And so that's like, I don't want to go back to like worse tech. Like, there were like those picture signals back then, the 90s, they, if you go earlier than that, the 70s, the 80s, looked bad because that was as good as they could do. And so, like, my thing is always like, I want the clarity of the ability. We have the ability to be clear now. I'd like the clarity. And so it depends how much it's designed with that stuff in mind, because if they're letting you turn it off, then I'll turn it off because I want the clarity. But It's one of those things where, like, does it fundamentally have an impact on the way that I'm playing the game, on the way that I'm reading the level design? Am I missing out on something? Am I interpreting what an object is wrong because I have this optional fuzzy filter on? That's when it would kind of get in my way. But it's one of those things where it comes back to my thing of, like, game devs and auteurism and, like, the idea of, like, the creator, where I'm just like, how do you guys want me to play this? Like, have the conviction in your design to lock those things on if you think they're intentional.
It's funny because I like that they're there because some people, you know, just won't want to experience that fuzziness like you mentioned. But for me, every time I turn them off just to experiment with the different graphical options that are on display, because there are loads, like I said, there's the VHS mode, there's a 1999 mode, there's a 1995 mode, and a couple others, or you can just turn them all off.
That stuff sounds great. In this case, sounds awesome.
Totally. So you can kind of tailor it almost to your own nostalgia and your own kind of favorite style of retro media, which is fun. But
Do you turn CRT filters on in games where they didn't have them in the first place? Like loads of games that come out now, like the Sonic Mania, or like the different Sonic collections. Like, some of them obviously were CRT, but like loads of games now have CRT filters. Their photo modes have CRT filters. I personally hate that stuff.
Only if it defaults to that.
Right.
And it defaults to that here, so I kept it on for the entire thing. I kept it on, or maybe I even turned it on with Signalis as well.
Yes.
If it's an
optional... I turned it off in Signalis.
Right. If it's an optional thing after the fact that it doesn't default to that, I probably wouldn't because it just seems like a novelty, but... The games where it seems like it's designed with that in mind, I like to have it on. And this does seem like it's designed with this in mind because, like you said, the way you read levels is different if you turn it off because everything is way more clear. Mm. You can see the items. You can see the boundaries of the level. You can see what's in shadow and what isn't. And that almost made the game too easy for me. So I liked the kind of obfuscation of it in having to... literally creep around the entire house because I didn't quite, wasn't able to fully gauge where I was or how dark something was or whatever. So it worked for me, but I just know it won't work for other people. But hopefully they still get a good experience out of it if they turn the stuff off, which is why I think the devs included it.
Mm. I'm definitely going into it wanting the old school throwback approach. Like it seems like counter to that, to then sort of gussy it up and make it super clear and make it look like it just dropped right now. Even though I do have a soft spot for really pristine pixels and really pristine polygons and voxels and everything. But in this case, it feels like such a confident, like, art direction. Like that's what you're going in for. It should be that. I'm super, super curious. I just know that I don't have time. Like, I'm trying to cram Final Fantasy 16 into the next 3 days.
What?
Because then AEW is out, and I just want to play AEW. I've been waiting for an AEW video game for, like, 3 years.
Dude, Fantasy for, like, 10 years.
I know, no, it's not going to happen. Final Fantasy we're waiting for seven years. That was 2016. It's not going to happen. There just are too many games. Dead Space in the corner. Dead Space never getting another look at.
Dead Space is dead.
It takes up dead space, to be honest, at this point.
We're going to jump into Final Fantasy. Mm. For me, because I don't have the AEW game to look forward to, or really anything else until maybe the end of August, Final Fantasy now is like, that's my new game, and I can take my time with it, which is really exciting, until I go back to all of those other puppet combo games.
Do I have my little list of stuff? I have a list of games that are coming out. I don't have that much in July. There is an Expanse video game then. For August, though, that's when Sea of Stars is out, and Under the Waves and Sonic Superstars. So that's another three for me. That's a month, a bit away. So.
I didn't know Under the Waves was August.
Yeah.
That is great.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
There's all the Marios. There's all sorts of stuff. Final Fantasy 16, though, to pivot into that, you've started it. I'm about 10/11-ish hours in. I'm not going to do any spoilers. We'll not do spoilers outside the demo. I think that's fairer.
Yeah.
We should be able to talk about the stuff that's in the demo because even in itself, there's an event that happens towards the end of the demo, which is sort of interpretational anyway in terms of what the game wants you to think. I know the resolution of what they're hinting at, but I'll not obviously reveal it. But I think it's just, we need some sort of grounding here in terms of what people have played.
Yes.
But where you are on it, I've played a lot more of it than you.
Well, here's the thing. Can I just say initially, before I actually started to play it, the hype...
You barely could.
Well, yeah, it's true. But the hype was so through the roof for this game. You had such positive reactions to it.
Man.
The internet had such positive reactions to it that we don't get paid until this week. We only get paid.
Right, okay.
But I just needed this game. So I was scrounging down the back of my couch trying to find any money that I could. I was
Sell Zelda.
The music boxes. I traded in some old Euros, converted those over, and I finally got enough money. That's how desperate I was to play this game. I was just like, right, I need to find this money somewhere in this house. And I managed to, which was great. That's all the physical money money in my house. This is one of those gone now.
One of those habit things as well, because you had enough euros lying around that you hadn't converted. How do you have euros lying around that you hadn't converted?
I've got all £20 notes lying around that I haven't converted, and I need to do that at some point because I know the cutoff point's gone, but I think you can still take them.
My head's in my hands, Josh.
It's terrible, man. I'm bad. This is why I don't use money anymore. That's why you only use
you can't use that money, you've just lost
digital money. That's it, because it just lies around the house and it's behind couches and it's just I'm a nightmare person, man. I'm a nightmare person. But the point is,
that's how, even a meal with that,
you could. The point is, I was so hyped to get this game that I jumped through all those hoops because I needed it. And then I finally sat down with it last night, and unfortunately it immediately overheated my machine, so I saw the first 30 seconds of the game about 5 times, but then finally got into it. And it's an interesting game. It's way too early for me to properly come down one way or another on it because I have so much of the game to see. I will say that by the end of that 2-hour period where you told me the demo ends,
yes,
I think that final cutscene is genuinely incredible.
Yep.
Got me into the story massively. The voice acting and performances in that scene were unreal. The spectacle and scale of it was something that, even though I'd seen the trailers, I still wasn't expecting it to go that hard and feel so big and
it
feel
is next
so epic.
Level.
We're going to talk more about the combat, but in terms of just the visual presentation of it, the cutscene direction, the grandiosity of the story, I am incredibly excited to see where all that goes.
I want to ask you about the Game of Thrones-iness of it, because it's emerging as a bit of a divisive point as people have got hands-on with it across the weekend. Very divisive overall, Final Fantasy 16. There's one portion of, I'm not going to say the fan base, one portion of people out there having a go that it's a PlayStation exclusive, so it gets getting review bombed over on Metacritic because it's associated with PlayStation, so a lot of Xbox people are annoyed about that. There's that side of it. There's the combat side of it, because it's nowhere near what a traditional Final Fantasy combat system would be. There's the Game of Thrones-iness of it, where a lot of stuff is almost quite literally lifted from Game of Thrones. Like, you pretty much have a direwolf. There's various ways the scenes are framed at the beginning, especially, that are very like Game of Thrones. The even the line delivery and some of the more like sort of sexually charged nature of the characters is very Game of Thrones tone. There's all that stuff. Everything is working for me.
Yeah.
I'm like largely completely on board with it. I think it's a little bit weak in terms of this. What's happened in the story, but I also have to hope that they're playing a hand, that they're playing quite a slow burn hand, and I'm curious what happens holistically, because it opened so strong, and that was, the video that we did across the first few hours of the game, I was so effusively praising it, and it's not that I wouldn't necessarily now, but it has settled into a different rhythm. It opens in a very different way than the way that it settles, and I think that it'll chop and change around, and there are definitely spikes of like incredible 5-star stuff. I had proper jaw-dropped, oh my god, this is phenomenal stuff.
Nice.
But it doesn't keep that needle pinned, and it almost kind of, it's almost like languishes a little bit. It really does take its time in certain spots.
Yeah.
And then they start giving you certain story beats that, at least to me, were extremely obvious hours prior, where you're spending so much time and so much production on having these big, drawn-out conversations with characters just to tell you the thing that the audience already knew, because we have a different perspective on things as the audience anyway, jumping between different factional conversations and stuff. So I think it's the weirdest Final Fantasy. It's a weird thing. Part of me kind of wishes that they called it something else, because not entirely. You can still have it be Final Fantasy. Something we had Stranger of Paradise, and that's not getting held up to anywhere near the same degree because it's fundamentally different. Final Fantasy Type-0 on Vita was a different thing, because it's named differently. Or sometimes all it takes is a different name. I think if you'd called this, you know, Final Fantasy : War of the Icons or something like that, maybe it would have saved everything in terms of the divisiveness of it. Because I'm not on board with the it's not a Final Fantasy people, but I know exactly what they mean. Like, it's very obvious.
You know me, man. Like I said, this ain't my franchise. I don't have skin
That's why
in
I'm super curious.
In that way. But I love that this is a numbered Final Fantasy experience. Mm. One, that kind of confidence got me interested in it massively. Mm. If this was a subtitled spin-off, I probably wouldn't have bothered with it, because I'd have been like, well, that's just over there. It doesn't seem substantial, because this is such a change and it's got that numbered title. Mm. As an outsider, I'm like, what's all the fuss about?
Yeah, they're committing to it.
Yeah, they're committing to this. Where's this confidence coming from? What is the direction of this? But I totally get people thinking it's strayed too far away. Mm. If you're a fan of this channel or podcast, you'll know that I love games taking big swings with sequels. Even if it doesn't always work, I like to see how malleable a franchise is. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, though, the Game of Thrones influence, which is obviously there right from the very start. Mm-hmm. Honestly, for the first half an hour, I kind of was a little worried and cautious, because entirely personal tastes. I liked Game of Thrones, but I already have Game of Thrones, and yeah. I don't need imitations of that. I've not watched even the House of the Dragon spin-off because it's like, okay, I've got that experience. I don't need Game of Thrones light or Game of Thrones adjacent. So when they started like talking in those thick British Yorkshire accents and they started throwing around the word cock all the time. I'm like, oh, I've done this before, man. I've been here. But by the end of the demo section, I guess as we're referring to it as, it managed to meld that intrigue and that setting with something that, at least to me as an outsider, felt more Final Fantasy infused, or certainly more fantastical in general, with the icons, with the scale of it. And then I was interested. Once that scene happens towards the end of the demo where you get the betrayal, you get the king who gets beheaded in front of the sun, you get the big fight between those two icons, a fight to the death, and the kid dies. I just, by then, I was sold. And I thought, okay, on paper, this might not be my thing from a setting perspective, but you've sold me on it, and now I want to know more.
We should talk about the action stuff, because the way they've designed the, because their whole thing, Yoshi P, Naoki Yoshida, you know, the one of the dudes responsible for Final Fantasy XIV, the producer on this, his whole thing was like making it the Final Fantasy for the Call of Duty fan. Like, how can we get the wider audience in? And some of the tropes that they're leaning on, some of the ways that they've designed a almost on paper mass mainstream action game. There's a lot of quick time events. There's a lot of like different gameplay modes for like a section. Like the very first thing you do in the game, I think, is the worst thing you do in the game, where you control Phoenix and you're just pressing triangle to fire volleys of rockets at Ifri. That's all you do. You can evade, but you very hardly ever need to. That's one thing. There are lots of quick time events in some of the boss battles where it's just sort of like, oh, when the screen goes blue, press square. When it goes orange, press R1 or whatever. I think in the moment it works. I never hated quick time events. I was never that guy. I always loved God of War and quick time stuff. I never hated Spider-Man's versions of it. I think they're fine. They're definitely an implementation, but they are very much an outdated implementation. If we're conversationally, they totally are. They're definitely they're referred to as something that the industry moved on from or whatever. And I feel like Naughty Dog or Insomniac, like they found ways of doing them where the scene is still fundamentally interactive, but doesn't necessarily rely on a big button coming up on screen. So like some of the stuff that they're leaning into is like, it's like Western gaming 101 kind of thing. And like, how do you find that? So how did you find that, like that Phoenix Ifrit fight? And then how do you find the combat in general?
The Phoenix Ifrit fight, like there wasn't much to it, like you said, but I thought as an opening salvo, cinematically it worked for me because I thought, I can't believe we're starting with something this big. I was interested in what the hell was going on. As someone who doesn't know Final Fantasy lore, I had no idea what these things were. They were just big monsters to me. So then when you get the reveal towards the end, when you revisit it and you play through it with a bit more control and you can aim it and you realize it's like, it's Joshua and someone else. And I was like, that has recontextualized it in a really good way. It worked for me presentationally, but yeah, it is a mechanical introduction. There's not much there, but I can kind of understand why.
Yeah, it's like trying to like ease people in or whatever. But it's there was something about the way that they lean on some of those tropes that it just felt like Final Fantasy is like this big totemic force in gaming. It has been for like over three decades. So to see them sort of like lean into tropes, like established tropes elsewhere, these are the guys that make the tropes. Like for them to be so aggressively Game of Thronesy and so aggressively referential, and like I think that's part of why a lot of people are bouncing off it in terms of the, it's not my Final Fantasy, it's not a Final Fantasy or whatever. I like I said, I'm not fully with that. I'm not even with that crowd at all, even though I can see what they're latching onto. The majority works for me, but it is one of those things where it's one of the only times that Final Fantasy has aggressively leaned in a direction they never have before,
right,
just to get a more mainstream appeal.
Right. I mean,
it feels like that anyway.
It's funny, man, because some of the most effusive praise that I had heard coming out of the demo was around the combat system.
Yes.
And I don't know if they give you more abilities in the demo than
they massively do.
Right. In the final game, that opening 2 hour stretch, I'm not going to say the combat system is bad. It's way too early, but it doesn't make a good first impression for me.
Okay.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Plus, the combos that I was using like weren't there. It was the same four-button square combo, and I could use ranged attacks, and I had one of the R2 specials. But I was trapped in some of those big boss fights with the... Is it mobile? Is it? The big like sort of plant mouth thing that you fight at the beginning.
Oh my god, it has different names in different Final Fantasies. I think in this one it's called Lele Modura or something.
Okay.
It's like a Molduga. I forget. It's right. Got different names.
Anyways. Well, I was fighting that thing with the same four button combo and the same kind of like basic attacks, and I thought,
are you not unlocking stuff?
At that point, I don't know. Maybe I could. Maybe
you totally can.
Maybe I could, and I just didn't.
I immediately paused and bought the charge stuff.
Right. Like, well, funnily enough, the thing is, I did after that section. You go back to Clive. I immediately went into the menu and bought all of the moves, like the downward like slash, and you get another R2 special. So I bought them all. Then you probably could have initially, and I didn't.
I might be misremembering. I thought I had a wider variety of stuff. But either way, it doesn't push you towards that stuff very well at all.
That's it. Either way, even if you could unlock what I've got unlocked now with Clive, let's say, and I could be totally wrong about this. I just didn't think there wasn't much variety there, and I was trapped into those lengthy boss battles that went on like a little bit too long, and it was a fine combat system. Like, it was still satisfying, but comparing it to the first impression that Final Fantasy VII made with its combat system, where you could swap between those characters and it felt like you had a bit more depth, and I was at least doing more combos. It was more confusing to me as someone who hadn't played Final Fantasy, but it felt like there was depth there to learn, whereas in the opening of Final Fantasy 16, I've kind of got to grips with it so quick and then managed to get bored of it by the time those 2 hours were up. But that was, like I'm saying, that's incredibly early doors, and even when I jumped into modern day Clive and had more of a moveset and did those unlocks, it started feeling better. It started feeling more diverse in what I was doing. So I kind of hope it continues that trajectory going forward, and I do get more stuff.
Yeah,
and fights are more interesting.
That's the thing. They walk such a line with this that you can see exactly what they're doing. Like, they're taking a vested largely turn based associated RPG franchise and making it Devil May Cry for 40-50 hours. How do you onboard that entire fan base to like this whole other way of playing? And there is like action. There's like an action focus or a story focus in the options you can just like toggle on or whatever. But they try and walk that line to sort of like give you a really basic set of animations, like attacks and ranged attacks and whatever, and they hold back so much on giving you another icon. It takes like 5 or 6 hours before you get a meaningful upgrade to what your square and triangle and circle even does, in terms of like the holding R2 and the special moves and stuff. And that basic circle move does change. Like, when you have Phoenix, it's a dash, and you get different icons, and that changes the different things.
Cool.
One of them is like a defensive, like fundamentally defensive stance. It's in the demo. Once you finish the story portion of the demo, they give you like a combat arena, and they gave you 3 different icons to play with. I think it was like Phoenix, Garuda, which is the wind one, and Titan, which is the rock one. So like Titan's the buff, the Titan block thing. So there's more there, but it takes hours and hours and hours. And like obviously like in amongst the maelstrom of the varied reactions to this, like I can't think who it was. Some journalist just said, I'm done with it. Like they were 12 hours in, they were like, it's not grabbing me, I'm done with it. And I feel like there is like a mixed response to it because the combat is being referred to so much as like this masterpiece. Like the guy that, the DMC combat designer that they got in from Devil May Cry referred to this combat model as his masterpiece.
Really?
So like, yeah, so it's like by the end, it must be incredible. And like in the demo, like you're cycling between three different icons, like where I am in the game, I've got three. But they do a whole thing where like two of them are the same one, it's a whole thing. And so like the way they do that stuff, it's like I have more moves, but I feel like until you have that, it's very repetitive.
Yeah.
And like the whole thing as well, just to tie into that whole thing of like they're onboarding like a populace between genres. In old Final Fantasies, you were building a party, like, you know, you were building different ways that spells would combo off each other, or like, you know, different buffs based on the items or whatever. You were making a party build. You're not doing that here because you're not like customizing anyone else. Like it's only Clive. So in terms of like the build mentality that goes into a Final Fantasy, it's only to do with the combat. Like you're just choosing what moves should I slot together that will work together. Like this launcher goes into this aerial combo, goes into this downward thrust, which means that they're weakened and I can do this. Like that's the build bit. And then it's up for debate whether that still is a Final Fantasy or not.
Yeah, that's like something alien to me, Scott, because even though that was in Final Fantasy VII, didn't use it too much, truthfully.
You must use materia and stuff.
I use materia, but I use materia not in the same way that you did. Like I use as kind of, I'm using the special moves in this game. Or I used it to heal a lot because use Aerith's heal a lot. But
hold on, this is funny because this will be one of those gaming habits things. Yeah. You didn't get lost in the materia system in terms of like, oh, if I chain like the all materia with fire, I can then cast to everybody. Or like, oh, I put the heal on a certain elemental buff so I block all fire because fire's attached to the elemental.
No.
Really?
I used whatever made the numbers highest. I used whatever made me have more defense or offense. I did not tailor it to specific enemies apart from maybe one or two really tough boss fights. Okay. But I never found like I had to. I was getting through fights relatively well, and it's not to say that system isn't great or there isn't depth there. There obviously is, just in terms of how I played that game. I played it more like a straightforward action game. I played it more like I'm playing Final Fantasy 16.
I wonder if they monitored people's playing habits and just said like, look, this is what everyone's doing.
Yeah,
let's just
maybe
do this. Because the materia stuff, I think it's like phenomenal, but maybe it almost is fundamentally optional.
I don't know, man. Like, I guess on certain difficulties, I definitely feel like it is. I remember you talking to me about your second time through FF7. Yep. You played it on hard mode.
I was just saying, the hard mode is that game.
Absolutely. Totally. And you were talking about how the combat system just opens up and everything clicks and it's like got that depth to it. But yeah, that depth, at least in the early hours of 16, isn't there. And I am confident that it will get there. It's just in terms of first impressions, I'm kind of waiting for that combat system that everyone is raving about to properly kick in. And like I say, I'm two and a half hours in, you know what I mean, out of a potentially 80 hour game if I do all the side missions. So I'm not expecting it to be fully formed at the go. I was surprised that the story and the cutscenes got me in more than the actual gameplay. I do have one legitimate gripe, and I would like to be either told that this is going to get better or it's going to stay the same all the way through.
Yes.
The level design, I really don't like in terms of how linear it is.
Yeah,
and
it's
how
very Final Fantasy 13.
Right, okay.
It doesn't stick like that.
Even when you're outside in like a forest or a canyon, it feels like you're always in a corridor.
Yeah.
And I don't love that at this start, and I hope the level design gets more interesting and varied and better.
It does, but not for about 8 hours.
I'm okay with that as long as it does eventually.
Even the stuff where it opens up, you get much bigger land masses and there's things to find, you can run around, there's like random enemies to encounter and stuff. It's not, at least where I am, and I guess I'm about 10 or 11-ish hours in, it's not... Like, I wouldn't say to someone who was looking forward to that, buy the game for this. It's just that they do start to relax that stuff, because that was very noticeable. One of the biggest things that people hate Final Fantasy 13 for is because it was entirely corridor-based.
Well, I mean,
for 20 hours.
FF7, the remake, you know, that has a lot of areas that are linear and are obviously sometimes literally just corridors.
Yeah.
But I didn't mind it so much in there because what I was looking at was gorgeous. It was like this world that felt fully formed, and everyone who's played the original already knows how good the world is, but this is my first time experiencing it.
Uh-huh.
So I was loving like the little environmental flourishes, the buildings that I was in.
You're describing Final Fantasy 16 to me here.
Is that? Well, here's the thing. That's great to hear.
No, but from the beginning, though, like immediately.
Really?
Yeah.
What, in terms of the actual level design?
No, well, in terms of like loving what I'm looking at, the world being fully formed, them using the crystals to just pour some water for each other, like that stuff, all that kind of stuff.
But I've only had that once. I've only had like that one castle scene where I've seen that stuff, which I really enjoyed. But I just mean that everything else in terms of gameplay level design has just been you're in a, like I said, an empty canyon that is crumbling. And there's nothing to look at, no environmental storytelling in that way. You're in an empty bog. You know what I mean? It's just like, I'm sure that'll get better. I hope it does. That kind of just exacerbated the feeling that I was walking down these combat corridors, and FF7 to me kind of had that more stronger start where it was like, here's the world and here's something to ponder. Whereas, like I said, in 16, it's like, here's a big canyon.
No, sorry, you're totally right. I mean, the 7's remake, like you do the bombing run, but then you're immediately back to hang out with everyone and go to the bar and you can run around and everything else. 16 takes its time. You do go to like various villages and stuff. I thought you meant like, and I guess you do mean like literal landmass wise. Does it ever become just more freeing in general? And it does, to different degrees. There are just bits about like 6 to 8-ish hours in where you do get a way bigger landmass and you can just run the whole way along it. And it feels like you want a chocobo to explore it with or whatever.
Well, so yeah, that's it. Like my favorite part of the demo, my favorite part of the demo section, was the, like I said, the betrayal at the castle, the siege in that castle. Because at least when I was doing combat encounters, it was in this lush location. It was on fire. Mm. You're in this castle that has all of this environmental detail. You've got the plot drive. You've got these characters coming in and out. Where it was just kind of contrasting that with the immediate level afterwards, where it's Clive after the Titans have been, well, the icons have been fighting, and then you just sort of like, I lost that sort of flair in the environment. Yeah,
no, that's totally true. They do a weird thing that there are Final Fantasy 13 comparisons being made to it, but it's, I mean, like, again, I'm waiting to be able to view it holistically. But if I'm just talking about the first sort of 10-ish hours, then yeah, there are a lot of corridor bits. There are a lot of just big old cutscene. You regain control. You walk forward a tiny bit. Another cutscene. Like, I love that. I love the presentation. I'm there for the grandiosity of it. And it, for me, I've found that it does have a nice blend of gameplay and cutscene. And when I'm in those more open-ended bits, I'm doing everything in those spaces. Like, I'm talking to the NPCs. I'm doing everything. I'm finding all the items and I'm fighting everyone. I'm getting as much XP as possible. That's when it really feels the most like a Final Fantasy. Like, here's a space. I'm going to grind everything out. I want to find everything that's here. But yeah, it walks a weird line between those things where they need to front load you with a lot of world building stuff and a lot of character drive, because that's kind of all they have. Mm. They structure wise, story wise, and again, it's only for the first bit that I'm on, it's nowhere near the framing device of previous Final Fantasies. Like 15 was a major departure for that because it was just you and the boys trying to get to a wedding. And then over time, Arden, who was the main villain, like appeared, but he was barely a presence. It was just towards the end. It was just, oh, I guess this evil dude needs sorting and he's superpowered, so we should go fight him. Nearly all the other ones have laid out their stakes pretty clearly. And obviously the most iconic villains are Sephiroth or Kefka from 6 or Kuja or whatever from 9. Like, they're always immediate, or like Seymour in Final Fantasy X. And maybe they want to get away from that because they want to make it more mature and they don't want to be like, here's this one cackling villain. There are multiple cackling villains, or there's a whole faction that needs to be taken care of or whatever. And 12 was a bit more like that. But it's one of those things where I kind of long for it a little bit. The only drive that I have right now is entirely based around Clive, where he's just searching for the truth, what happened on that night with the big betrayal thing, and just trying to find that out. And it works as a character piece. And I love Clive as a character, but it doesn't have that wider feel yet. And I hope it gets there. That's what I'm aching for.
Without the context of the other games and the drive of the other games, it's working for me.
Yes.
There is sort of like a villainous faction, I guess, they establish early on. I would fully agree that Clive is the hook for me as well. And the biggest moments have been revolving around characters that I didn't even think I would care for. But then I absolutely have. You know, immediately following the demo section, you know, Clive runs into a character. And that was a big moment.
The character of the year. If you're talking about Cid, I don't know.
Oh, well, who
could
knows?
Be somebody else.
I might not be talking about Cid, who knows? But he runs into a few characters, and immediately I thought, right, this connection, this relationship, that's what I'm interested in right now. Like I said, it's the Game of Thrones thing where the scale is so big, and I'm so bad at keeping lore in my head. I don't know anything about the houses in Game of Thrones. I won't know anything about the houses in Final Fantasy 16, but as long as I know the characters within those houses and how their relationships function and their dynamic, that's enough to drive me along. Mm-hmm. And in this very early stage, I'm absolutely hooked on the story because I want to know more about who these people are.
Are you doing the active time lore stuff?
Yes. Yeah,
because that's so helpful.
It is.
Like, I mean, I even every time, I pause every time some new character gets mentioned or whatever. It's like the view on, like, I think Amazon still has it on the Amazon Prime thing.
Yeah,
where it brings up the actors and whatever. It's kind of like that.
X-ray system.
X-ray stuff. And it's kind of like that. And so, like, I like that as an approach, because it's like if someone mentions a term, like, oh, the Bastards or Sam Breck or whatever, or Rosaria, it's like, okay, I can just pause and look up the history of that place. And I love that stuff, just being available.
Yeah.
So I've been doing a lot of that, but it's so much headcanon. There's so much stuff to remember. There's, like, there's different regions and different factions and different, and there's, like, we're talking about an 800-year history of the place anyway.
Yeah.
They refer to the twins, which aren't even a people. Like, there's just lots of stuff going on.
Like, it was so helpful, and I knew that I was going to be able to stomach the story and lore more than I thought I would when I, you know, use that system. Mm. And I figured out what the, again, I've forgotten the name of it already, but the big power that all of the things are situated around, that they're fighting over initially.
Sure, the Mother Crystals?
I think so. The Mother Crystals, like the big, there's loads of different mountains, right? They're like the big mountains.
Yeah, there's loads of different types of Mother Crystals.
Yeah, you're totally, but I know there's like five in the region, and that's what all of the main powers are situated around. That's what I know.
Yes, you mean the crystals. Yeah.
Like the big,
because there's only a certain amount of dominance as well.
And then there's
all the specific regions.
Totally. Just to be able to figure out what that was, at least in the broadest terms, was really handy for a dummy like me who has a brain like a sieve. Falls through.
I don't think that's a you problem at all. I think that they are relying on you pausing, because you wouldn't even know the active lore stuff was in there unless you happen to pause a cutscene. I don't think they really flag it.
They flagged it for me, which was nice. But
maybe I found it first.
You might have.
Because it was one of those things where, like, because I paused and because I was then diving into the lore entries, that did help with the framing of what's happening between, like, the Iron Bloods and the Dalmekians, and we're all in Basthea and whatever. But, like, that level of, like, you're being very terminology heavy. Yeah. I want to get really good, like, meaty lore. But, like, you do need to take a minute to sit back and just read for a sec.
Totally. And to be honest, that's exactly what I signed up for with Final Fantasy 16. I didn't sign up for just an action game. So when I see the criticisms online about, like, too many cutscenes, I'm like, man, even as a non-Final Fantasy fan, that's what I'm that's what I want. Like, that's what I've come to this series for. Yeah. I want to know what the fuss is about in terms of the story and the cutscenes, the presentation, the world building, because it's something that I don't usually get in the action-heavy games that I play. So to have that stuff right at the start, I was able to ease into it and think, okay, like, I want to go on this journey. I want to know what a Final Fantasy story looks like. I want to know what the presentation is.
Phrasing it that way is the bit that makes me itch, because I'm just like, I think it'll get there, but I'm so cautious of someone going through this as their first Final Fantasy. And then, like, the bits that work are obviously beautiful and brilliant. We can talk about them. But maybe it'll change. But even then, 10 hours into Final Fantasies 7 through 10, far more had happened. Like, way more had happened. Way bigger stakes, way bigger world depictions, whatever. This is assumedly going to be a Final Fantasy story overall, but it isn't one yet.
Don't get me wrong. When I say what a Final Fantasy story is, I don't mean that in terms of specific themes or characters or structures or anything like that. I mean it purely in terms of a story-heavy game that has a lot of cutscenes.
You know what I mean?
And is over the top in terms of its visual style and choreography. And I'm getting that right now. I know that's an incredibly reductive way to surmise that franchise, but it's kind of like, it's the same thing I would say if I went, I want a Metal Gear story. It's not about the themes necessarily. It's like, I want it to be cutscene-heavy. I want it to be, like, constantly shaking up where I am. And whatnot. It's funny with Final Fantasy as a series, though, because, you know, we always joke that you're always like, you've never played a proper Final Fantasy. You know what I mean? Because I've only played Final Fantasy Remake and now this. But it just makes me question, if this also isn't a quote-unquote proper Final Fantasy, like, what is?
And
it almost seems like, as an outsider, is that not a reductive way to look at the franchise, that at this point, if I can play two main installments in it, those aren't considered proper Final Fantasy games, then I'm like, I don't know, maybe the criteria is wrong, I don't know.
It would be like playing like Halo Wars or Halo Spartan Assault and then being like, well, they're Halo games, so I've played two Halo games.
Not main ones, though. That's kind of the difference, I would say.
The number thing for 16 definitely justifies that. Like, I mean, yeah, it's just one of those things where we talk about like franchise associations or gameplay styles that things move away from over time. Like, Metroid, like, it was like, if you'd only played Metroid Prime, that's a beautiful, recommendable game, but you haven't played like a proper Metro because you've not played Super or a 2D one. Like, it's just those weird occasional franchises that go between like vested identifiable elements for multiple decades and then switch and get more people in, but they were never there at the start.
Again, though, I'd say
that's... Nothing wrong with it. It's just that's what I would be referring to.
I would say that's, again, as an outsider, that's different because I look at Final Fantasy Stranger of Paradise and I know that's not a main one. That I wouldn't have the core Final Fantasy experience if I played that, mm-hmm. but it's if Halo, the gameplay of Halo was in a game called Halo 6, you know what I mean?
Nah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
I would be like, well, that's the main Halo. Like, that is what Halo is right, now, right, you right. know, and mm-hmm. it's the same with this. It's like, I've not played Metroid Prime, but to me, when playing that, I would know that it's not what Metroid is because it's subtitled, or it's a different title. It's a spin-off, whereas with 7 Remake, I guess that does have the caveat of it being a remake. But with 16, it's like that's a kind of like a main installment. Mm-hmm. Is that not a Final Fantasy? Is that not just what Final Fantasy?
Welcome
is
to the
now?
Ongoing debate between all the community and everything. I mean, it is. It's numbered as such, but then at some point, it's just a title. Like, it's going to see how it feels like holistically by the end of it and everything else. I mean, like I said, I'm not with the. It's not a Final Fantasy like crew, even though I can point to things and be like, oh, I kind of think more stuff should be happening by now.
I'm just a. Maybe I'm just a mad hippie, right? But I always, not saying you specifically here, but I wonder if what people define Final Fantasy as is what they just viewed it as when they were kind of younger and experiencing it for the first time. Like,
I think
things not changed to a certain degree where...
Honestly, at some point, if you play, even if you just play like half an hour of Final Fantasy 6 through 10 or 1 through 10, like, if you played any of them for, like, half an hour or an hour, you would see how they're so massively different.
No, I'm not saying they're not different. Don't get me wrong. But right. I do genuinely have an issue with people telling me, and I know you've done this before, but I don't mean this, like, in a personal way. From a conceptual level, when they're like, you haven't played a proper X. Like, I know you may have done it before with Breath of the Wild.
I mean, I largely think that. So, you might as well just say it.
No. I mean, I was saying it now. I just don't want to make it sound like I'm saying, you're gatekeeping this.
Right.
That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying, like, personally, I'm like, well, I don't understand. You tell me that Breath of the Wild isn't a proper Zelda, but I'm like, man, like, to some people...
Well, traditional Zelda.
Yeah, traditional Zelda. But to some people, that's going to be the only Zelda they know. And going forward, if that's the new norm, like, that is fundamentally... what Zelda is now, and why can't something change to that level? I don't know. I understand saying it's not a traditional Final Fantasy or anything like that. I get it. But to say it's just outright not Final Fantasy, that's kind of where, as an outsider, I'm like...
You're attaching worth to that statement, though. Like, they are different. They can just be as valid as each other. Like, new Zelda is just as valid as old Zelda. It's just not the same. Like, like I said, that's why it's, like, traditional Zelda. Like, old school Final Fantasy, that's why I use the word different. Like, they all have value. It's just, like... Yeah, if I'm saying Final Fantasy 16 isn't a proper Final Fantasy, then like it's because there are so many defined terms for those originals. But it doesn't knock the quality of both approaches.
I like when you use like it's not a traditional X.
Yeah,
there's so much baggage, not from you, more from the internet, when people say this isn't a proper thing.
Yeah, they then go down the value thing and be like, oh, it's worse, it's terrible. It's like, no, it's just different.
That's it. To me, it feels like it's almost gatekeepy-ish to say it's not a proper thing, because it's like, man, like, why do you get to say that it's not? It might not be a traditional Final Fantasy, but to say it's not a proper Final Fantasy or to say it's not a proper Zelda because it has dared to deviate, that's where I get a bit defensive, because I'm like, no, people will love this style. To some people, this will be that franchise to them, for better and worse. And I would love the conversations of, is one better than the other? Like, traditional versus contemporary. Those are the kind of stuff that we talk about all the time.
Dude, totally.
And I love those conversations. I do just, I guess, get my back up when someone would say, like, nah, you haven't played the right one. And I'm like, can't tell me I haven't played the right one. You can't say that. Like, it's
no,
not
they're
up
all,
to you.
They're all right ones. I think, that, yeah, I'm fascinated by that stuff, too. I think, I mean, at some point we're talking linguistics or semantics or something in terms of the way that things are labeled or discussed or whatever. But I think, I mean, yeah, there are various tenets to this particular IP that have, like, you know, become known, become loved over 3 decades, 35 years or whatever, 36 years, that I guess some people miss or some people do associate with it or whatever. And those things are not in here. And, like, I can get super granular about that stuff because I, like, have played all those games. But yeah, it doesn't take away from the value that this game brings to the table. That's everything that we've said on this podcast doesn't negate the quality of Final Fantasy 16 whatsoever. It's just massively different. That's one of the most fascinating parts about it. It's because the value is in there and then holding them up next to each other. Like, it's what you said. It's the compare and contrast.
Absolutely, which is what I love. And it's just funny going to different franchises and seeing people more protective over what they view is proper and what isn't. Like, one of my favorite franchises of all time that I talk about every single day is Resident Evil.
Right.
And weirdly, in that franchise, there isn't necessarily a consensus of what is proper Resident Evil or not, because it's had so many changes. You've had the tank controls, you've had third person, you've had first person. Mm-hmm. And it's just strange to contrast the fandoms, because you can go into them in Resident Evil 7 is just as valid as Resident Evil 4, which is just as valid as Resident Evil 2. Of course, people have their preferences, and that's where the discussion comes from, but it's funny going over to other franchises where people just say, nope, that isn't.
Resi's a really good one, because if you came in on 6, that would be the Final Fantasy 16 of Resi.
Yeah.
And then you were like, oh yeah, I've played a real Resident Evil. And then I would probably be like, you haven't really though, because they've changed it so much. It's not that you can't love that game, but it's nowhere near Resi 4 or the original trilogy or whatever tenants we would then pull from that would qualify what a Resident Evil game is.
Yeah.
They're in 6, but they're remixed or watered down to such a degree that it brings in that mainstream audience.
I think that's
a really good comparison.
No, that's an interesting perspective, because I sort of wouldn't do that. Like, someone who had played Resi 6, I'd be like, you played a Resi, you played a bad one, but it's as valid as the rest, especially because, like you said, it does carry over some of the themes and some of the... It's a natural progression of what was started in 4 and then 5 and then they moved to 6.
But not 1, 2, and 3. Not the lifeblood of the IP.
Totally, totally not.
That's the argument at the core of the Final Fantasy thing.
But I wonder whether that's just because they don't find Final Fantasy 16 good, because I'd say Resident Evil 4 doesn't have the lifeblood of 1, 2, or 3. That is a completely different game. And even at the time, people were probably saying...
I don't know. I think a lot of the campiness is still in 4. Like, a lot of the presentation is the same.
True, but could you not say that about Final Fantasy 16, that a lot of the presentation is the same, or they have the bare bones of what was in previous games, you know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you go back to, like, if I talk about Final Fantasy again, then, like, the originals, especially, like, 1 through, more so, like, 6, 4, 5, and 6, are, like... Yeah. Way lighter tone, like way more campy, like especially in terms of the characters in 6, and then like 7 was like the grim dark kind of let's save the planet kind of one, and then 9 was super light again. Like that's a whole granular thing.
Oh, totally.
But like, overall, though, like generations of fans.
Yeah, 100%. I guess my point with Resi would be that Resi 4 was accepted because it's viewed as one of the best games of all time. But if that game was only a 7 out of 10, you might have got people saying they changed too much. It's not a proper Resi, like with Resident Evil 6, you know what I mean? But to me, the jump between 4 and 6 is not as big as the jump between 3 and 4.
No, and it's one of those things, like, when they try to do the mainstreaming with Bomberman. It was Bomberman X, and they made, like, third-person shooter and stuff.
Oh, okay.
On 360, I think it was. And that was the one that just didn't work at all. Yeah. Like, you know, these come around every now and then, like, try and bring in wider fans. If you're getting completely subjective about it, I do think there's enough Final Fantasy-ness in 16. I think that a lot of the best parts about it in terms of the icon pals work better because they're playing off 30 years of depictions of those characters or those creatures. But it's just there's a certain level of like whimsy or adventure or like fantasy or whatever, like high fantasy and lighthearted adventure based fantasy that is like usually Final Fantasy's lifeblood. And like they've gone around the block on that like so many different times. And Final Fantasy 12 was quite a big depiction for departure from it. It's just that thing with 16 where like, yeah, I agree. Like it's just as valid as the other ones. Then the more interesting part is comparing them. But I can't not identify how different it is. Like it's same as if it was Resi 6 or if it was Metroid or whatever.
That's absolutely it. And I wouldn't want anyone to overlook that stuff. I'm not at all saying that Final Fantasy 16 is a natural continuation of 15 or you could play that and Final Fantasy 6 back to back and like you would feel like you're playing the same series. Not at all, just to kind of rather, and again, you're not doing this specifically, I'm just seeing it doing the rounds online, to kind of shun it and say, like, we don't accept you.
Oh, nah, F that stuff. I think anyone who's just been like, it doesn't matter at all, I can't possibly look at this thing. Like, no, look at it, see what you think, genuinely. Like, I would apply that to everything. It reminds me of, like, the change of the guard in Star Wars fandom over the years. Like, the original prequels were like, Episode 1 received pretty well, but then immediately it was, like, sort of hated by the old school, but that's not what Star Wars is, it's this. And it changes over time, and now the the prequels are very much reappreciated in Final Fantasy's context. 13 was despised, but that was a lot of people's first Final Fantasy, and they got enough of that core, I'm going on an adventure, whatever it is, whatever that core feeling is, Final Fantasy was still in there enough that it works. Our own Adam Strawn over on the main channel absolutely loves 13, whereas I absolutely hated it, and I even going back to it over the years, I could never get it. And so it's like, hopefully there's enough of that core feeling in 16 that it'll be someone else's favorite Final Fantasy.
This is what I love, and this is why I love it when these main sequels have the confidence to properly slap a number on it and say, no, I know it's experimental, but we're not going to caveat this. We're not going to asterisk it. This is a main series, and we want you to just discuss it as a main installment. Like I said at the start, that's why 16 was so appealing to me, because I'm like, this is a bold swing for the main franchise. I need to know what's going on. It's not just treated with the caveats of, it's a side thing, it's over there if you want it. And I like it when franchises do that. I like it when Resi does it. I like it when movies and movies do it as well. You know, it's just
the flip side of that coin, though, is that they are then by default invoking all the comparisons to the previous 15 main installments,
absolutely,
which can go not in their favor. Like when they're up against some of the greatest games of all time, at least like from their respective eras and what they did with the whole of the genre and everything else. But that is also what leads to the best conversation. Like, I can't wait for you to see more of it.
Yeah.
Because like obviously my perspective is colored by 30 plus years of Final Fantasy, and like that's a great perspective for me to have, and it elevates a lot of the stuff here, but some stuff might not even matter to you.
And I love that perspective. It's why I want to get on board this train, because I want this game to be compared and contrasted to the other games in the series. I want to know what other games did better. I want to know what this does better. I want to know what other games did worse. I want to know where the story deviates and all of that stuff. That's why I'm here. That's what I want. I want this as part of a larger conversation, not just kind of on its own. I'm going to mention music for a second, right?
Yes.
Because I know I always talk about this, but it's why I love the Arctic Monkeys, right? They headlined Glastonbury at the weekend, but they released one of their most beloved albums of all time with AM, absolute smash, broke America, billion streams on Spotify.
Yes.
And they followed that up with this experimental concept album that was a lounge singer departure from their desert rock influences on AM, right?
Okay.
And initially, the band was like, this is experimental, this is weird. Do you want to just release it as an Alex Turner, who is the vocalist, an Alex Turner solo project? And then they ultimately said, no, this is what we want to do next. This is going to go under the banner of Arctic Monkeys. We want it to be analyzed within that canon. We want this to be the next step for the band. Mm-hmm. And I'll always love that, like, to have the, like, he's using the word confidence. Whether you like it or not, to have the confidence to go, we don't want to be defined what we've done in the past. This is the next step, and we want people to talk about it as the next step.
That's why I mentioned Metallica.
Love those convos, man.
That was why I mentioned Metallica when we did the hands-on with Final Fantasy 16, because they've always confidently said, no, this is Metallica. Even when it was the dog worst thing they were doing with Lou Reed, they were like, no, it's Metallica and Lou Reed. But it's going to be the same thing that goes around in circles in terms of, like, if you listen to the Lou Reed and Metallica album, you've not listened to a Metallica album. Like, it's one of the, versus the stuff that, like, Ride the Lightning or Master of Puppets, like, it's just not the same thing. Like, it's the same brand, but it's not the same thing. I think, like, that's the conversation that would just do the rounds forever.
Right,
You would be like, well, I've listened to, like, on paper a Metallica thing, but it wouldn't be the same core thing. And I think for me, my approach to those conversations is just telling people that there's so much worth in the ones that put them on the map in the first place. Like, there's so much worth in those original Final Fantasies.
Absolutely. I guess, I suppose that would be where we would maybe have an almost fundamental disagreement, because, like I said, if someone picked up Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, which is that experimental one from Arctic Monkeys, I'd be like, yeah, you've listened to a Arctic Monkeys album. That is who they are for that period and who they are now. But if you didn't like it, if it wasn't your style, don't worry. They have a bunch of different styles in their back catalog. They like try them.
And I love that for Metallica's main catalog.
Yeah. Like you said, I would always define it as that might not be quote unquote traditional Arctic Monkeys or early era Arctic Monkeys, but it's still part of them, and it's kind of like just navigating that without invalidating a certain era or a certain approach and whatnot. But yeah, like you said, we'll go around in circles on this one, but it's a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, man, I think all these things will kind of come to define Final Fantasy 16's place in Final Fantasy overall. It's already happening across like the weekend. It's already happening across social media in a way more vitriolic, violent way than the conversation we're having, because there's so much review bombing. There's so much, oh my God, F this game and whatever. Just take it on its merits. See what they're going for. My overall golden metric rule is just, what were they going for? What did they nail? They couldn't care less about doing a turn-based Final Fantasy at this point. And they're not even remotely trying to do it. So it's going to be conversations on, does the combat work? Does the combat build work? And then how does that, how do the mentalities that are in this game pair with 30 plus years of invested IP?
And I always think, right, correct me if I'm wrong, would you want them to do a turn-based system? Not in terms of like, would you prefer it? I know a lot of people would, but if their heart's not in it, like, if their heart's not in it, would you prefer something done to appease you if they're not passionate about it? Or would you prefer an action-driven focus that they actually care about? To me, I always prefer the system, even if it's not what I prefer, and I might not play a game because of it, that people are they're passionate to make. I know, obviously, when they were making, like, Final Fantasy VII or whatever, they were passionate about those mechanics. And then might not be for me, but I'd always prefer that than them chasing the mainstream just because they feel like they have to.
Which I guess is, you should never do something to appease the, I think you should just do the stuff that you creatively, passionately want to make and then see how that shakes out. Obviously, part of the discussion around 16 is how nakedly it's taking things from Game of Thrones and how nakedly it's doing mainstream mechanics like QuickTime events and things that we would say are outdated to try and get that wider audience in. That was the thing I said 20 hours ago when we started this about the way it's all kind of rolled out, the fact that they are Final Fantasy bending to copy this other thing. They've never really done that. And I think that's an interesting talking point in itself as well. But for now, this has been the wind-up. I don't even know if I did our names. I'm Scott Tilford. That's Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. And we'll catch you throughout the week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.